Okay, thank you, Veronica. So, well, first, it's a pleasure to be here. I've enjoyed the talks this morning and the afternoon as well, and the discussions, conversations that I've had with some of you. And as Veronica said, you're encouraged to, well, keep asking questions. So this is the logo of the program that we're attending. We've heard the talks have been mostly about this part of the logo. Now we're going to go to the center and see what's in there. We're going to talk about black holes, space-time, curved space-time in particular. That's something that probably you have heard, that Einstein told us that space-time curves, and that this is something that manifests as gravity. And that's kind of a representation of it. But you may ask yourselves, does this look more like ripples on a pond or wrinkles on a membrane? Is which way of understanding this curvature is better? Well, turns out that both are useful, and we're going to say some things about this. Space-time curvature. Well, one thing that I want to do during this talk is your teachers. I'm going to give you things that I find useful when I'm a research physicist, but I also do a lot of outreach. I go to high schools and I talk to students, and then I find things that work better, things that don't work so well, and then there's limitations in what I say. That's something that I want to tell you about, so that maybe when you go back home, you can use some of this stuff also to communicate to your students. So how do we understand the curved space-time? That space-time is something that's is not the thing that we usually think about. It's something a bit more complicated, more flexible. There are two main analogies that we use in order to convey this in a simple way. One of them is in terms of sinks, another one in terms of rubber seats or trampolines. Because what we know since Einstein is that, well, gravity is actually something that is not the same thing as Newton told us. Newton explained that, well, there's this universal force that keeps the solar system together. This is there's a kind of an invisible string pulling the planets, the moon to the Earth. It's pulling it, pulling them together. So this is some invisible, mysterious force. This picture changed when Einstein said, "Well, forget about the force. What happens is that these objects are distorting the geometry of the space-time around them, and then, well, there's no force. It's simply that things are distorting the space-time, and then when you move in this distorted space-time, your trajectory is going to change in a way that's going to resemble what looks like gravity." How do we discuss this? How do we explain this in a way that's easier to understand? Well, first of all, I mean, we have space and time. Let's just talk about space. There are three dimensions of space, but in order to simplify things, to make them more visible, more easily visualizable, what we can do is suppress one of the directions. Instead of the three axes that we have in this room, we just consider two of them and consider our universe to be flat, like a sheet of paper, or maybe like some big rubber membrane. And then, well, in this flat universe, one thing that you can do is, well, you can throw marbles like this. And what do? They follow straight trajectories. And this is the same thing that happens if you're out in space. You take a rock, you throw it, then it follows a straight trajectory. Okay. But then what happens if on this rubber seat, you put something that's heavy, you take a watermelon, you put it there, and then this is going to distort this membrane. Okay. And when now you throw your marbles, they don't follow straight trajectories anymore. They follow curved paths. And paths that, well, I mean, we're doing this thing that we physicists do, forget friction. We do this all the time. If there's no friction, then you can have, well, marbles orbiting around the watermelon in a way that resembles the way that satellites orbit around the Earth, or the moon orbits around the Earth, or the planets around the sun. And here you see that there's no force that the watermelon is exerting over the marbles. It's just that the watermelon is distorting the geometry, and then, well, the marbles are following their path in this distorted geometry. Okay? So there's no force. Force, the gravitational force, is some sort of illusion. This is what Einstein told us about 100 years ago. Now, this is a very good way of conveying in a quick, easy, visualizable way how something that's curvature of space-time can produce the effects of gravity. And as a teaching aid, it's something that's very useful because this is something that you can do in your classroom. I mean, that's you can do it live, and this is something that I encourage you to do. You buy to the, you go to the store, you buy the biggest spandex piece of clothes that you find, and then I mean, this is not mine, but I have something like this. This is not a picture of mine. And then you buy some balls, heavy balls of different sizes. You throw them. Take care that they don't that they remain within your universe and they don't expand to the rest of the room. But then this is something that it works very well with lay audiences and high school students. And it's also something that we can use in order to understand other effects, for instance, getting, we'll get later also to the black holes. But well, we had the watermelon. I mean, this could be a planet or a star. This star is going to distort this membrane in a way that creates this dip. If you put something here in the dip, then it's going to take, I mean, if this wants to crawl out of this membrane, well, you have to give it some velocity so that it gets out. Now you put a more compact object, say this could be a neutron star, then it creates a deeper well in the membrane, and then you have to, if you're down here, in order to crawl out, you have to start with more velocity. And then if the object that you create is something that's a black hole, then what happens is that well, this creates a well so steep that there's a point that no matter how fast you want to get out of this or how fast you can travel, then you will fail, because there's a point at which even traveling at the speed of light, you cannot come out of this place. And this is what we call the horizon of the black hole. Okay? And this is a way of understanding what some properties of curved space-time and the things that general relativity tell us about. And if you're more daring, then you can even do things like this. This is something that, well, it requires some work. You can find the video on YouTube here and explain how gravitational waves are produced when you have, say, two black holes orbiting around each other. Okay, so this is cool. This, actually, for this, you need a strobe camera, because the drill is spinning too fast that you don't actually see it. So this is shot with a strobe camera. I think that somebody told me that they've done it live with strobe light. But, I mean, that's, I mean, you require some skills in order to do that. I haven't tried. So this is something that works well. I think it's a great explanation, but of course one should be aware of what one is doing, because this is just an analogy. Okay? Here we're talking about curvature of space, and that's something that it seems to give us what we want, but actually the way that things work in Einstein's theory is a little more complicated, because it's there's space and time in Einstein's theory, and it actually what matters mostly in general relativity is curvature of time. Okay, that's something that I'm not going to explain here. Maybe if you want, we can talk about it during the question period, how to explain curvature of time. But I will not do it here because I also want to explain other things. Now, this is the the rubber seat, the trampoline analogy. There's also another way of explaining what general relativity does, which is to think of space-time as some sort of flowing liquid. And you can think of, say, there's these dams, these reservoirs that have these wonderful glory holes that, well, when the dam is filling up with water, then, well, this is the way that they can, when the water goes down, and then that's kind of a security valve for the dam. I think that there's one up in Napa, right? Yeah. So, well, how do we use this? Well, imagine that you have fish here and they are swimming. If they are far from the sink, well, there's no problem in swimming in there. They get closer, things get more complicated, and then that's how they disappear. And if you do this, then you have to show them this video. this is a video. I think it's something that somebody filmed it last year, and I think it maybe I think it was maybe the one in Napa. That's a cormorant. They say that no animal was harmed during this experiment, because or at least that's it's claimed that they saw the cormorant flying at the other end, because this goes down to the dam and then it comes out, and then they it's maybe that's just, and you're telling this to kids, you don't want to traumatize them, okay? So yeah, it works. This is something that works well, and this analogy of what space-time does and what a black hole is, this is a much better analogy than the trampoline. Okay, it's something that it's much more accurate. We can even get some formulas and some equations that get it almost right, but it's still, it's an analogy. Okay, it's not the real thing, it's limited. But it works. If you have time in your classroom to do one of these things, I recommend that you explain it one way or the other, you can try. If you try and you want to tell me how it works, then I will appreciate it. So that's the title of the talk is about, I'm talking about membranes and liquids. I already talked about what membranes and liquids for explaining what the space-time does. But as I said, these are analogies. There are other systems, other gravitational systems, where this description in terms of membranes and liquids, they are not analogies, they are actually accurate. And this happens when we describe the properties of black holes, and in particular of black hole horizons. Because it turns out that we've learned, and this is something that we've learned relatively recent years, that black holes can be accurately described by equations of soap bubbles and equations of liquids. These are equations of elastic membranes. A soap bubble is essentially something that's like a membrane that's elastic, that can fluctuate. And then there's also properties, equations of liquids, equations of fluid dynamics, that can capture accurately properties of or the behavior of black holes, at least in some regimes, in some limits. And this is something, I mean, we're talking about black holes, but then suddenly we're changing our language, we're changing the words that we're using, and we're talking about soap bubbles, or we're talking about some fluid. Well, this is one of the things that Veronica mentioned at the beginning this morning. I think it's a wonderful example of a unity of physics, that when you have nice equations, nice theories, they appear not just in the context where they were initially found, they also appear in other interesting concepts, in other interesting phenomena and contexts. Okay, and that's something that we've already seen. Matt explained to us this morning how out of things that are quantum you can get to concepts which are geometric, and we'll see some of this later on. So it's also, besides this, being a bit more precise, these are the things that I'm going to talk about are instances of dualities and correspondences that we in theoretical physics like to talk about, which is the idea that you can have a physical system, again, returning to the theme of what Matt was explaining, physical systems that can be described using very different, seemingly very different theories. And there was mentioned this morning of what's called the holographic ABS-CFT correspondence, which is this formulation of a quantum theory of gravity that we're studying in this building these days. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about is a subset of this correspondence called the fluid gravity correspondence. And here we have, Veronica was one of the people in the team who formulated this correspondence over a decade ago, some time ago. And that's, I think, one of the important developments in the field of gravity in the last decade and something. So let me now get back to black holes and give you a few ideas, some things that I think are important to understand, to discuss when talking about black holes. Black holes are essentially empty space and time, but highly distorted. Okay? It's something that you obtain after some matter has collapsed, but the matter then collapses, distorts this membrane. It goes down this throat, like this, then the matter gets somehow annihilated in a singularity, and we'll say something about the singularity in a moment. So it's empty space and time and highly distorted. And there are also extreme time dilation effects. So I said the idea is what I explained before, that you're curving your geometry more and more until there's a moment when the pull of gravity or the distortion of the space and time is so large that nothing, not even light, can escape from a region in your space-time. So this is the effect of, this is the reason that we call them black holes, because they are black because not even light can come out of them, and they are holes because that's what they look like. It's something that where you fall and then you cannot come out. There are extreme time dilation effects, and I guess that probably, if not all of you, most of you have seen this movie, Interstellar, which is great for, because also your students have probably seen the movie. And then, these are the extreme time dilation effects. As I said, I haven't explained time distortion in a black hole, but this is something that you can explain, or at least you can try to connect to what your students know about. The fact that when you go very close to the black hole, time slows down so much so that, like the astronauts say here at some moment in the movie, if you're very close to this huge gargantuan black hole, 1 hour close to the black hole is 7 years passing on Earth. Okay, and then you don't want spoilers if they haven't seen the movie, but yeah. So the horizon, as I was saying, it's the edge of what's visible. That's what we call the horizon. You cannot see beyond the horizon. It's the limit of what you can see. It's also a point of no return. Once you cross it, there's no way of coming back. And also, it's good to remind oneself that if you're falling across a horizon, particularly if it's the horizon of a large enough black hole, and there's nothing that's telling you that you've reached this point of no return, which is kind of sad. You may be doomed, but you didn't realize. And this is something that in very large black holes, and there are gigantic black holes, and the black hole at the center of our galaxy is tens of millions of kilometers across, you can fall across this the horizon without feeling anything. You would survive for maybe 10, 20 minutes. Then, puff, die. But it will be quick and painless, they say. Not that we have tried, OK? So it's not marked in space. It's just some region in space, just like in this membrane. You fall, and you're moving along this membrane. It's suddenly, if you try to, things at some point, you begin to get distorted, stretched in some directions. You don't even have time to feel that. It's quick enough, okay? Mercifully. If the black hole, the largest, there are black holes where I think that you can survive even for a day inside. There are some black holes which are billions of, 70 billion solar masses. That's kind of the record. I think that gives you time to survive. There's also stuff. You have to avoid what's flying around, okay? But if you manage that, it will only be space-time curvature growing that will kill you. What else can we say about the horizon? There was big news last year about the horizon. We have seen the horizon. No, we haven't seen the horizon. You cannot see the horizon, for God's sake. Why did they call it the Event Horizon Telescope? Of course, because it sounds good. But you cannot see the event horizon just by definition. You cannot see this horizon because the horizon is the place, the limit of what can be seen. A light ray there doesn't get out. Just barely, it's trying to, a light ray that's on the horizon is trying to get out, but it cannot. Okay, so you can see it. What you see is the shadow of a black hole. You see the matter around it distorted by the presence of the black hole, but the black hole here, it's black. So, and you don't want to call it the black hole shadow telescope. That's kind of bland and boring. Event horizon telescope sounds much better. I'm not going to say much more about this because the subject of this today's program is not so much the astrophysical aspects of a black hole, but more the theoretical aspects of a black hole, which is what we're doing. But we can talk about this later if you want. So this is the horizon. Let me say a few things about the singularity. Singularity, that's the end of time. And what do I mean by this? Because there's a lot of confusion about you go to popular explanations of the singularity, and I think that they are very often misleading. And whenever I want to see whether somebody who's explaining properties of black holes, if they really know their stuff or not, I see what they have to say about the singularity. If what they say is that, inside the black hole there is this point that where things blow up, that space-time, that the curvature becomes very, very large. It's like they think that you go into the black hole and then, well, there's that point over there where the curvature becomes very large. No, this singularity is not a point inside the black hole. It's an instant. It's a time, it's an instant in your future. What do I mean by this? I think you're all familiar with what the Big Bang is. It's the beginning of time, space and matter and everything. You can say that it's the day without yesterday. It's kind of this, right? I mean, you run the movie. Of course, it's not very accurate because it's not happening at a point. It's happening everywhere. But let's just say that it's the instant where everything begins. Well, you can run the movie backwards and have a big crunch, which is the end of time, space, and matter, and everything. It's the day without tomorrow. So what happens inside a black hole? Well, you have a little big crunch, a localized. You have your own end of the universe. It's a private final party. Anyone can join, but no one can tell, well, how the party ended. Because everything is invisible from the exterior, because that's what black holes are, okay? So this is what happens inside the black hole. Everything ends, comes to an end at some instant in your future. Okay? It's not that there's a singularity, a point inside. It's an instant in your future. And then this is the reason why you cannot avoid, once you jump into the black hole, why you cannot avoid reaching the singularity. Because there is this puzzle that I remember when I was kind of a teenager or so, and I read about the singularity, and they said, well, there's this singularity that's pulling everything towards it. And then I said, well, but why can't I just turn on my rockets and avoid, or just find my way around and not fall into the singularity? If the singularity is a point, I thought that there should be some way of avoiding falling into it. But not, no, I mean, if it's an instant in your future, you will reach the singularity for the same reason that, like it or not, after Sunday, Monday morning arrives. I mean, it's the passage of time that brings you to the singularity. Okay? If you tell this to your students, they will understand what it is. Okay? And this is a bit like, I mean, you know that there's these people, the singularitarians, these people who think that there's a singularity in our future where humanity will, well, humans will reach a technological level that we become immortal. I mean, they're thinking of the singularity in the right way, as an instant in the future, not as a point. Okay. Here it's the same thing. It's an instant in your future where that's what happens. Inside the black hole, well, there's no future. I mean, that's the end of time. But it's localized, okay? Nothing. No one who doesn't want to jump into the black hole will know about this end of time. So that's the singularity. Let's get back to the horizon, which is the main subject of what I want to say. Well, there's this property of the horizon that, well, the more mass you have, the bigger the horizon is, which kind of makes sense. I mean, maybe, I mean, that's depending on how you think about it. If you think about it the wrong way, you think that, well, if there's more mass, well, it's heavier, then it's going to be more gravity, then it's going to be more compact. The horizon should get smaller. That's the wrong way to think about it, because the horizon, remember, is the place that limits, well, the gravity becomes strong enough that nothing can come out. Well, if you have more mass, well, the horizon should get larger because there's more attraction, so there's more region of space where you can trap things, because the gravitational force becomes stronger and stronger, so there's more, a bigger part of your space where things get trapped. So this is a famous result, the result that gives you the size of the horizon for a black hole of a given mass in terms of the quantities that you recognize. This is Newton's constant, this is speed of light, and this is something that comes out of the equations of general relativity, out of a solution that Schwarzschild found, and there's a nice story that you can tell about Schwarzschild. That's, well, you can look it up in the internet, but if you're explaining this to your students, I think that story of how Schwarzschild found the solution, that's a good one. How can you get the result? Well, there's a way of getting this result, which in fact predates by more than 100 years what Schwarzschild did, which is you can compute what is the escape velocity. You know, the escape velocity is you're in the surface of a planet, and then you want to throw rocks so that they don't, well, they begin going up, coming down. If you throw them with enough speed, they go up, 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 and then, well, they never come back down, okay? In order to determine this, what you do take is kinetic speed or kinetic energy, potential energy, you set them to zero, and then, well, out comes a radius that tells you, if you have some mass, what's the radius of the planet or star that has this mass that is such that, well, if you throw a rock from the surface of the planet, it will not come back down. This is a calculation that was done by a man called John Michell in England in the 18th century. And, well, it's kind of a precursor of the idea of a black hole, the idea actually of a dark star. Yes, please.
Does this also imply the existence of so-called microscopic black holes?
Yeah, well, there can be, I mean, the possibility of microscopic black holes, it's something that is in the theory, certainly. Whether they were formed, say, in the primeval universe, that's something, well, they probably formed, but we don't know with what abundance and under what conditions. But primordial black holes, yeah, I mean, you can set the mass small enough, then the radius is going to be small enough. And I'm going to say a few more things about this relationship between radius and mass in the next few minutes. Now, so I was saying there's direct proportionality between the radius and the mass. Okay? This actually is something that you can see, this connection between distance and mass is something that follows very directly from the Einstein equations. The Einstein equations, I'm writing them down here. Maybe sometimes you see this is what we call the Einstein tensor. Sometimes you may see it expressed in terms of other quantities, but it's equivalent. Here, the idea is that you have something that's curvature, and here you have something that's mass density. And then we have some factors, well, 8 and pi, that's just numbers, but we have these constants. So we this is an equation that's relating the curvature that you have at a given point in your space-time, and also the mass density that resides in that region. Well, curvature, the curvature here, you measure curvature in terms of radius. The inverse of a radius is a curvature. Here, actually, what you have is the inverse of the square of the radius that enters. Here, I'm putting squiggle because this is just some, well, to get a feeling for how the equation works. So we have curvature. Here we have mass density, which is mass divided by volume. If you keep track of everything, then what you end up with is that you have a linear relationship, like what we found, between radius and mass. Okay, this is something that's generic, it doesn't apply only to black holes. What this is telling us is that in a gravitational theory, in Einstein's theory of gravity in particular, and if you also take into account that mass is energy divided by c squared, you know it the other way around, it's energy equals mass times c squared, but here what it's telling you that in gravity, higher energy means larger distance. The higher the energy, the longer the distances that you're exploring in your system. And maybe you're familiar with the idea that in quantum physics, we have the opposite relationship. Lengths are inversely related to energies. Maybe you've heard this idea that, well, if we collide particles at the LHC, at the collider in Geneva, we're colliding them at higher and higher energies so that we can probe shorter and shorter distances. The idea is this relationship, because the physics that's probed in these colliders is quantum physics, where the higher the energy, the the shorter the distance. But if you were having a gravitational system, it would be the opposite. You put more and more energy, well, you're reaching your field, your gravitational field is reaching farther and farther, or your black hole horizon is becoming larger and larger. That's something that's important. It's an important property of gravity. And it also allows us to do something that's funny, because it's to use this theory, gravity, to measure masses naturally in units of meters. What do I mean by this? Well, you're probably familiar with the idea that when we have the speed of light, we can use the speed of light in order to measure distances, say, in seconds or in years, and we use light years. And that's something that we're familiar with. A light year is not a unit of time, it's a unit of distance, which is the distance that light travels in a year. And then, well, if you have this constant, this universal constant, then you can just forget about meters and measure everything in seconds. And then we can say that we live 8 minutes away from the center. I mean, we do this all the time. I mean, maybe we live 8 minutes away from the center, but then, well, you have to ask yourself, 8 minutes by car, on foot, or what? Well, here we're using the speed of light, which is just a universal velocity in this universe. Okay, it's something that's constant, uniform. So we're using this. We're using essentially the formula in this way. And if we say that we live 8 minutes away from the center, well, you know what center we're talking about. It's the sun, the center of the solar system. Okay. You can also use the relationship in the other way, because who told you that you have to write this equation this way? You can also write it like this. And then you can measure time in meters. So instead of saying that you have 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, you have 300,000 kilometers, I don't know what it is in miles, 300,000 kilometers, 600,000 kilometers, and so on, every what you could call every second, right? So you can measure your time in meters, which is the distance that a light ray would travel in that time. And then, well, this is my age, okay? And you see, so this is the distance in time that I have traveled during, well, since the moment that I was born. And I've traveled around the world, but not nearly as much as this. We're traveling in time, mostly, and that's something that's important. I mean, the technical way of saying this is that we're time-like, we follow time-like trajectories, which we're moving mostly in time. We're almost not moving in space. Now, this is something that's, if we have C, speed of light, but now we have this other universal constant, which is G. And with this, now we can have this, you can say it's a conversion factor between mass and distances. We can measure mass in units of meters. You tell me your mass, and then I can convert it to some distance. So what do you do if I take my own mass? What distance do we get? What is my mass in meters? Well, it's this, millimeters. This is my weight. What does it mean that this number is so small? Well, what it means is that I'm not very attractive. I'm hardly attractive. I'm not repulsive, okay? But I'm hardly attractive. But it's not only, oh, I mean, it's same for you, all of you, okay? But even the Earth, the weight of the Earth is 1 centimeter. And the Earth, of course, is much bigger than 1 centimeter. This means that the Earth, even if it's gravitationally, it's stronger than I am. But it's not so much. And even the Sun, the weight of the Sun is 3 kilometers. Whereas the Sun is, I think it's 1.5 million kilometers across. So the Sun is not so attractive. Which objects are very attractive? Well, black holes. Black holes are objects whose weight in meters is the same as their size. And they are maximally attractive. So you wear black if you want to be more attractive. Doesn't work, sorry. And then, but then you can say, well, the radius of a black hole with the same mass as the Sun is 3 kilometers. So a black hole is a very tiny object. Okay? Yes?
So does that mean that black holes have the maximum possible mass?
They compress mass in as small a radius as possible, if you want. Or if you give me some size, there is so much mass that you can put inside that size. I think that's the way to answer your question. You fix some size, and then you begin to put mass inside it. Well, when you form a black hole, then a horizon appears at that radius. And then if you keep adding mass, then the horizon is going to keep growing.
That's where you can have black holes of different solar masses.
We can have black holes with 1 solar mass, with 10 solar masses, with 1 billion solar masses, or with a few grams. They could also exist. They would be extremely tiny. If you wanted to compress me to form a black hole out of me, or of you, or anyone else, not me, this is the size of the black hole that you would get, which is tiny. Okay. So now you see, we needed both these quantities, G and C, in order to do this. If we had just C, we wouldn't do it. We need a relativistic gravity in order to have this connection between mass and energy, this geometrization of the mass and energy. We don't need H-bar, we don't need quantum physics in order to get this. But this way, I mean, this idea that we're taking everything, mass, energy, and everything, and making it geometric, that's the essence of general relativity. the essence of these equations. Okay, yes?
So what was the mass of the universe?
It's about 10 billion years. I'm now using measuring mass in years, which I can also do.
What about distance?
Hmm?
What about meters?
So it's meters. Can I give it in light years?
Okay.
I mean, you convert from a light, so a light year, that's how many meters? That's it. So a year is 10 to the 7 seconds, so it's 3, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 22 meters, more or less.
Okay.
Is that right? I mean, any, yeah? Yes?
Given a particular mass of a black hole, does the evaporation constant then over time?
It grows. You add a mass to the black hole and then the evaporation grows.
It grows if you add more mass.
Yes.
Okay, but so say you don't add more mass.
Okay.
It doesn't contract, I mean...
Yeah, it doesn't contract. If you don't add anything, the evaporation stays. If you add any mass or anything, the event horizon stays there.
I guess what leads me to wonder about that is this question about, is that the maximum what was your question about the maximum density?
Is that the maximum mass that the black hole?
Yeah. So, say that we have some spherical box, and then we begin putting mass into it. We put a kilogram, nothing happens. We begin adding mass, then there's more and more distortion. When we put as much mass as the radius of the box is in meters, then at that moment a horizon appears filling in the box, and if you try to add more mass, well, the radius of the horizon grows, and then, well...
Okay, but the singularity, I mean...
The singularity was an instant. Is that okay? Now, another thing about black holes, sometimes black holes are portrayed as some static thing in space, but they are not static at all. They are highly dynamical objects, and that's what we're going to talk about. You take a black hole, then you can, if you're able to, you have to manipulate it some way, you have to be careful, you have to put some gravitational fields so to move it, but then you can boost it, you can give it a kick, and then, the black hole can also rotate, they can spin, and this is something that you can understand with the fluid. It's kind of what you have in your kitchen sink. And they can also vibrate, and that's what we're going to talk about, horizon vibrations. Well, we've seen that space-time can wiggle. We had this video of this membrane that was wiggling and then doing something that resembled the gravitational waves. You take a black hole, you throw a rock into it. Well, this rock, it has some weight, not too much, but it's going to gravitate, it's going to create some distortion in the space-time, it's going to just distort the horizon in such a way that the horizon will wiggle. It will begin wiggling, and that's something that you can see in videos like this one, SXS. This is something that happens in a black hole after some collision, it's wiggling. This is a pictorial representation, but this is actual calculation of a quantity that... So you see this is wiggling, this is vibrating because this is something that's being distorted.
What happens to make that wiggle start?
Well, this is just a snapshot part of a video where you had two black holes which are colliding, merging, and then that's, I didn't want to show the entire video, but it's a very nice video that you can find in the web. So you can say, well, the horizon is wiggling. You can say that the radius of the horizon is wiggling, the radius is changing, but you can also say, in a sense, that the mass density, that you can see that it's kind of wiggling as well. This is something that you would describe in terms of elasticity, and this is something that you would describe in terms of fluid dynamics. But we know that radius and mass density here, they are equivalent. You can use one language or the other. We can use the language of elasticity, or we can use the language of fluid dynamics in order to describe these wiggles. Now, this is remaining here at the level of words, but we can make this more precise, and it's also something that's very important, because this horizon, these wiggles of the black hole horizon are very important for what we know, or what we can learn from gravitational waves, these wigglings, and the black hole is vibrating, and then at some point, you saw that in the video, well, it's kind of damping down. It's becoming, it's relaxing down to equilibrium. So these are damped oscillations. This is why we call them quasi-normal vibrations. Normal vibrations, this would be undamped oscillations. If they decay with some profile, this is what we call quasi-normal vibrations, damped oscillations. And you know that if you have some system that's vibrating, its normal modes, it's something that we use in order to characterize that system. We can learn a lot about an oscillating system or about a system by hearing how it oscillates or seeing how it oscillates. So the quasi-normal vibrations of a horizon also help us identify a black hole. And this is something that, well, we can do with the signals, the gravitational waves that we get from black hole collisions. There is this signal that was detected famously. Well, of course, this is a simplification, but LIGO detected gravitational waves from a merger of a black hole. The black hole has formed, a single black hole has formed out of two, and then it's relaxing down, it's ringing down. And the ring down here, this part, this is what's called quasi-normal ringing, and this gives us information about the nature of the black hole that's formed at the end of this process. So that's important. These are vibrations, wiggles of the horizon. And as I was saying, then we can think of them as fluctuations in the mass or the energy, the density of some fluid that's propagating and then dissipating. Now, these are words. It may seem a bit fuzzy to you now, but can we make this more precise? Yes, we can. But if we want to make it really precise, then we have to do a few things. We have to consider, instead of black holes, we have to consider black strings, or what's called black brains, objects which are extended, so you can have waves propagating for a long distance. If the black hole is just a sphere, well, the waves don't have that much space to propagate along. Whereas if you put some ripples here, then they can propagate along the direction of the string, or the direction of this thing that's called a brain. These objects, by the way, only exist if we allow ourselves more space than dimensions, more space dimensions than we have. These are called brains because this is silly physicist humor. Of course, it's a pun. It's a membrane, and then you have the membranes, but then you can have more dimensions. What do you call them? Well, the person who came up with this first called them P-brains. And then, well, the name stuck, and they are called brains, black brains. Now, if you study the fluctuations of these brains, black brains, you study slow fluctuations, and fluctuations which are very long wavelength, then Veronica and her collaborators found that the Einstein equations that describe these fluctuations reduce precisely, it's not just an analogy, it's something that's a mathematically rigorous statement, that the Einstein equations that describe the vibrations of these, the fluctuations of these black brains, are the same as the equations for a fluid. Okay. And this is called the fluid gravity correspondence. So here we have the horizon behaving as a fluid. And there are some nice examples of black holes behaving, or black strings in this case, behaving as fluids. This is again a video that you can find in the, let me see, can make it work, yeah. So it's in YouTube. This black string turns out to be, if you put it there, it will become unstable and develop this kind of structure. And if this reminds you of something that you may have seen or not, this is a liquid tube. So this is a solution, complicated solution of the Einstein equations, took a supercomputer. This is just human saliva. It looks similar, right? Yes?
Does space-time have a restorative force?
If you want to say that, I mean, something like something that tends to dissipate things, well, there's a restoring force, there's some elasticity, we can measure, this is not elasticity, this is more dissipation. Space-time has viscosity, if you want, and we know what the viscosity of space and time is. Using this, because we can take the Einstein equation for space and time and then put these equations in the form of equations of some fluid, we obtain what is the viscosity of this fluid, which is a very low viscosity, by the way. So, you see, and that's something that, well, this is not fully solved yet. It's given us, at least some of us, a bit of a headache trying to make this more precise, but it's I think it's a good illustration of how the two systems are actually, they contain the same physics. Now, this is black hole, the horizon as a fluid. Can we say something about the horizon as a membrane, as a soap bubble? Because after all, soap bubbles, you know them, they are spherical. Horizons are spherical. Of course, horizons, if they rotate, they are not exactly spherical, but also soap bubbles, if they rotate, they are not exactly spherical. Also, horizons, they have a property called the surface gravity, which is some measure of how, what's the curvature at the horizon, it's uniform. It's constant over the horizon. And soap films, soap bubbles, they also satisfy an equation, which is an equation of a constant curvature. If you want to find what is the shape of soap, of some soap film, well, you have to solve an equation that was first formulated by these guys in the, at the beginning of the 19th century, which says that the mean curvature of the surface is constant. The mean curvature, I mean, you have some surface, it has two radius of curvature independent. You can have find characterized in terms of two the curvature in two orthogonal sections, and then the mean curvature over these surfaces, it has to be constant. This sounds, this looks very much like the equation or this property of the horizons. Is this something that we can make more precise? Is there more to this idea that the shape of a horizon, that a horizon behaves like a soap film, like a soap bubble? Can we make this not just an analogy, but a precise correspondence? Well, in order to get to this precise correspondence, I have to explain, because it's a bit of a peculiar limit, and then let me get again. I mean, we physicists, we're isomorphic. We have the same sense of humor, because you mentioned the spherical cow. Matt mentioned it. So, well, our equations are hard to solve, okay? So we have to resort, we have to find ways of simplifying them. And then, well, I don't know if you can read. So you assume a spherical cow of uniform density while ignoring the effects of gravity, and then in a vacuum. So that's what we do. And then, well, you see what people think about us. I don't know if you bastard theoretical physicists, how do you sleep at night? This is what, I mean, I found this googling up a spherical cow, but I think it's, yeah. I mean, these limits that we take, at first, well, they may seem a little unrealistic, okay? I mean, this is not exactly a cow, but then, I mean, they give us a start. And then once you have this, then maybe you can pull legs out of the cow and then make it a bit more realistic. But you have at least a starting point. So what do we do in practice? I mean, that was the spherical cow. But you may have some theory or some equations where you have some numbers or some quantities that, well, they are not actually fixed, maybe relatively fixed, but in your equation you might take these parameters that you have in your equations and then you can change them. They can take some value and they can take another value, but the equation still makes sense. And I will give you a couple of examples in a minute. And then for some, maybe for some extreme values of the parameters, the equation simplify. I mean, for instance, here, the shape of the, it could be the shape of the cow. Well, I mean, you can consider there are cows which are fatter, cows which are slimmer. Some of them, they may be so fat that they begin to resemble a sphere. Well, you take the limit where it's actually a sphere, and then, well, things become simpler. In actual physical theories, for instance, a famous example is quantum electrodynamics, the theory of electrons and light. And, well, some people made quite a lot of progress with this theory. This theory, I mean, you can consider electrons. The electron has a charge. In this universe, the electron charge is one value, but it's something that in your equations, you can change what is the value of the charge of the electron. You can put, instead of putting the actual number, you put a quantity that you call Q, and then you say, well, what happens when Q is a small number? Well, the equation simplifies a lot. And then, well, you get some mileage, you can solve equations, and then you can get Nobel Prizes if you're smart enough. So that's been a very useful strategy for analyzing this theory, considering that you have a parameter that you can change, and then even if it's not the real world, because in the real world the electron charge is what it is, then you take the limit where it's very, very small, the electric charge, and then, well, you are in business. We heard this morning about something similar. It's a bit more sophisticated, this theory of quantum chromodynamics, which describes what happens in the nucleus. There are these quarks, there are gluons. Well, this person also realized that if you take the theory, where instead of having gluons of just three combinations of colors, the colors that you can have, well, as many colors as you like. I mean, that's, you know, wonderful. I mean, that's first, I mean, an infinite number of colors. And then in this limit, well, the theory simplifies a lot. And that's something that, well, with, it was discovered some years ago that it also gives us a handle on the theory of quantum gravity, which we heard about this morning. Now, this is for these theories. Of course, the universe in our theory, the realistic theory, has only a finite number of gluons. But this is something useful to consider. Now, in gravity, we can consider the limit where we have an infinite number of dimensions. And it's not that we believe that the universe has an infinite number of dimensions. It's simply that in our equations, we have some parameter, which we can call d, which is the number of dimensions, and our equations make sense for whatever value of d. And then we can take these equations and say, well, what happens if we take this value to be very large? And the equations simplify. They simplify a lot. How? Yes. So this is more or less what space-time or the geometry around a black hole looks in four space-time dimensions. We like to say that our universe has four dimensions. We mean three of space, one of time. And you know that the force of gravity, as this gentleman here told us, the force of gravity goes like 1 over r squared. Now, you can study the force of gravity in spaces or in universes with a different number of dimensions, and in general, the force of gravity is going to go like this. And if you take d to be very large, a very large number, say you take d to be 100 or 102, so you have 1 over r to the 100. What does this, if you plot 1 over r to a very large power, what does this look like? What does this force look like? Well, it's something that's very flat when r is large, and it's very steep when r is small. So this is what the geometry will look like. I mean, it's almost flat here, and then very steep close to the horizon of the black hole. So then let's say that now we want to take the limit where d becomes extremely large. Well, then this becomes more and more steep, and then at some point we may decide, well, we can just as well replace this by just some surface, because all of the gravitational effects of this object are concentrated in a very thin sliver around this horizon. So we replace this with some surface, we give it the properties that the Einstein equations tell us that this should have, and then we get the equations for some membrane. The equations of the gravitation, the vibrations, how this is vibrating, is going to be translated in vibrations of this membrane when d goes to infinity. And then what we could show is that if you do this, the Einstein equations for the horizon of this black hole in an infinite number of dimensions, they become precisely the same as the equations of a soap bubble. So black holes are like soap bubbles. Well, if you just allow yourself a little more room, a little more dimensions, well, an infinite number of them. But this is something that we can make precise, okay? Now, so what I think, well, one of the lessons of what we've been talking about is that the Einstein equations, they are amazing equations, okay? And they are rich enough to contain whole other areas of physics. You have within the Einstein equations, they contain the equation of fluid dynamics. In another regime, they also contain the equation of elasticity. There are more things that they contain. So these equations are really remarkable. And let me end my talk with a quote that I really like by Heinrich Hertz, the guy who discovered the electromagnetic waves. He said, he was referring to the Maxwell equations of electromagnetism, but I think that this applies even more so to the Einstein equations. One cannot escape the feeling, well, he wrote it in German, but I cannot escape the feeling that these mathematical formulas have an independent existence and an intelligence of their own, that they are wiser than we are, wiser even than their discoverers. I think that this is the feeling that many of us work with these equations and with our best theories of physics. This is the idea that, or the feeling that we get, that these equations know more than we do, and we have to go ask them, and then they give us replies, and then we learn from them. And that's remarkable. I mean, that's something that is telling us something deep. I'm not exactly what, but I think it's deep. And with this, well, I'll end here and thank you.
Questions?
there a vacuum energy around for space-time, right?
Yeah.
And if you're around a black hole or a planet, does the vacuum energy change?
Yeah, the black hole distorts the space-time around it, and then it can also distort the distribution of energy of other things. Yeah, in particular, vacuum, it distorts the structure of the space-time, and it doesn't change so much. Vacuum energy, or at least what we call the cosmological constant, it's typically relevant over distances which are much larger than the size of the black hole. So the effect of a black hole on the vacuum energy is typically very small. Or the effect of vacuum energy on a black hole is also typically small. Because the vacuum energy is something that's important as cosmological, say, billions of light years across, whereas black holes are much smaller.
It's very fascinating that these equations are related to fluid mechanics and elasticity. You did not talk about information, its no. relation to information. Are you able to share a new viewpoint on that?
Yeah, well, the experts already spoke about this, right? I mean, the relationship between information and geometry, that's something that we're learning about. I mean, if things that you've heard about today, if they sounded confusing, it's because they are not fully clear to us yet. I think I would defer to the other people. I don't know. I don't have much more to add or to say. I mean, there's something that has to do with, which is deeper than the Einstein equations, okay? So what I said is that the Einstein equations contain this, but there's something deeper than the Einstein equations. The Einstein equations are contained within something deeper, and that something deeper seems to be something that's quantum and related to quantum entanglement. So there's even deeper layers, and probably there's even something even deeper than that. But that, for that, well, stay tuned. But I cannot say much more that's, that would sound sensible.
Other questions?
My colleague back here asked earlier about the radius, if you have the whole mass of the universe. Yeah. How does that affect the Big Bang? Is there a limitation on how small the Big Bang could be, or does that not apply for some reason?
What did you say?
The black hole what do you call the radius? The horizon.
Yeah, this relationship between radius and mass, that applies not only to black holes, it also applies to the universe. So the mass of the universe, it's, if you have some universe, some mass or energy density, then, well, it may create a large horizon around it that's going to be, and we call it the cosmological horizon, that the relationship between the cosmological horizon and the mass contained within that horizon is given essentially by the relationship that I showed there. So I'm not sure whether I'm replying to you.
The original mass at the beginning of the universe, did that specify a limit on how small the universe could have been and still escape out?
Yeah, let me see. I mean, there's the universe, when it was very small, it has some energy density and there was a horizon. When you talk about the beginning of the universe, we have to say which moment. I mean, are we talking about the moment of inflation, after inflation? The time when there was this inflation of the universe, there was some vacuum energy that was driving the expansion. This energy, the energy that was contained within some regions, determined the size of a cosmological horizon and expanding the inflationary horizon. I'm not sure I'm saying things when I'm replying to. If you're, are you happy? No, not terribly happy. But,
some physicists and astronomers hold that the universe didn't begin with the Big Bang, but that it began a long time before that, and that the Big Bang just started its expansion, not the inflation that you are speaking of, but just started the expansion. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah.
In the light, can I go a little?
Yeah.
In the light of your own research? In other words, does that inform your researching at all? The second question, what... What does mass do to time and space? What is there? If this, I know you wanted to avoid saying it emanates, that mass emanates something, but I'm hoping that you'll visit that a little more. And the last question is from my sisters and brothers sitting here working with their students. I made a gravity well out of plumbing pipes, plastic plumbing pipes, mm-hmm. and I bent them into the necessary shapes over the regular gas-fired cooking stove, and it's easy to buy the elastic membrane that covers the top. And the whole thing cost me under $20, and I made it one afternoon. I got tea fitting, and I'm just a girl.
So, I mean, first you started talking about the Big Bang. I think that we physicists are to blame for using the Big Bang in different senses, in different contexts. Sometimes we talk about the Big Bang as the hot Big Bang, some period after inflation. Sometimes we talk about the Big Bang as something at the beginning of inflation or even earlier. We don't really know what, well, how the universe started. There's some ideas, but there's speculations. Yes, but what I'm saying is that when you refer to Big Bang, I'm not sure to which Big Bang of all of the Big Bangs, the sense of the word Big Bang that we use, you were referring to. Probably the beginning of time, because, if it's the beginning of time, then, you were saying that some people think that there was something before the Big Bang. Well, right. If it was before the Big Bang, yes. Then that Big Bang wasn't the beginning of time.
Yes,
okay?
That is what I'm saying.
So, I mean, if there was some beginning of time, that's, as Lemaître was actually the person who said this, the day without yesterday. I mean, there's no yesterday. It's just like if there's a big crunch, there's no tomorrow. You live like there's no tomorrow, you live like there was no yesterday.
Do you?
I don't know. I don't, probably. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's what was the beginning of time? That's something that we don't understand. We can do some maths, we can do some... I'm not replying to your question. Yes.
What does mass do to time and space?
That's what it does. This is what I'm saying. So mass distorts the geometry of space, but it also distorts the passage of time. The closer you are to a heavy object, the slower the time runs. So these clocks are running more slowly than these clocks.
How does it do it?
Good. You're saying, how does it do it? So instead of asking this question, what I'm going to say is that this is what gravity is. This is what gravity does. Gravity is the thing that makes you go to the places where time is running more slowly.
I understand what you're saying.
Yes, so this is, instead of talking about a force, gravity takes you where a minute will be an eternity. I'm being poetic, sorry. gravity, what it does is takes things to where time is running more slowly.
So you see it not as a thing, but as a kind of energy.
Something that the universe does. It's not an energy, it's an effect. I mean, you can view it as something. I mean, we are saying that we were eliminating gravity as a force. We're replacing gravity as something that affects it's an effect of the curvature of space and time. Uh-huh. Now I'm talking about the curvature of time. Curvature of time is the, in a sense, it's the thing that time runs at different rates at different places. The places where time runs more slowly are the places where we normally say that gravity is stronger. And then things tend to go to where time runs more slowly. This is gravity, according to Einstein.
Is it just gravity, or is it also just special relativity too? There is a metric that's invariant,
yes.
And if you're going to influence space or distances, you're also going to influence time.
Yeah. So you influence both things. Special relativity is the theory of general relativity without dynamical gravity, without gravity. So space and time are related, but if you want to have this local distortion that changes from place to place, then you need gravity. In special relativity, everything is uniform. here things vary from point to point.
Okay, so let's thank Roberto.
There was one more.
Okay, let's have one more. Sorry, I didn't see you.
So just kind of putting things together from the previous talks, and I think what you just said a bit, if quantum properties may lead to the shape of space-time, and the shape of space-time leads to gravitational effects, does that mean it's fair to say that there may be only three fundamental interactions and not four if gravity is not one of them? Is it being removed from the...
Yeah, we're here removing... So Newton told us that gravity is a universal force. Einstein told us that gravity is an illusion of a space-time curvature. What we're learning now is that space-time is some manifestation of entanglement structure of something. So we're removing things. We remove gravity as a force. Now we're removing space-time. We're removing space. We're not removing time yet. When we remove time, what will we end up with? I don't know. I mean, if we have time, then we can have quantum mechanics. That's the idea. You can do quantum mechanics as long as you have time. You don't need space. You can do quantum mechanics with time, and that's what we're trying to do. Out of quantum mechanical systems with time, then we can grow, space can emerge. If we want to go deeper, then we have to remove time from the mix. We have to go beyond quantum mechanics, probably. We don't know. I haven't replied to your question, but I said some things that sounded nice. <enough. laughs>
Okay, well, on that note, let's thank Roberto.